I am the father of children. I have a 12-year-old and very soon to be an 8-year-old. The 8-year-old likes to watch television. Well, so does the 12-year-old. She tries to convince me she can do her homework and watch television at the same time, a skill I was never able to master, even in the days when there were only 3 channels, and the programming, even the kind of programming geared toward me when I was a 12-year-old, was pretty slow by today's standards. Now, everything moves so quickly, and there's so much to watch on television, and yet at the same time, so little to watch on television. What kind of harm does television do, not only to our children in the cultural sense? We talk about that a lot on Issues, etc., but also in terms of just their basic psychology, their ability to think, and, as we're going to discuss here in the first 25 minutes of this last hour of Issues, etc., their ability to pay attention. Yesterday we spoke a little bit about the myth of the waning attention span, but a new study is out that draws a link between early television viewing and attention deficit disorder and attention problems later in life. We're going to talk with Dr. Jane Healy about that. In the second part of this hour, Gretchen Pasentino is going to be our guest. We're going to talk again, as we did earlier in the program, about the ABC TV special Jesus and Paul. She was very carefully watching last night out there in Costa Mesa, California, taking notes, and already has posted on the answers.org website for Answers in Action her take on Peter Jennings' latest offering on ABC television. We'll talk with her in about 25 minutes. Our call-in numbers are 505-7850 or 1-800-730-2727. Dr. Jane Healy is and has been an educational psychologist and professional educator for 40 years. She's author of several books, including Endangered Minds, and her latest is called Failure to Connect. She joins us from Vail, Colorado. Dr. Healy, welcome to Issues,
Etc. Thanks, God.
What does the new study show about the link between television and our ability to pay attention to everyday life?
Well, it shows clearly that kids who are exposed to a lot of television early on, and by this I mean amazingly early, as young as below 1 year, and through those very infant and toddler years and the preschool years, when the brain is forming supposedly really good connections for future learning, the more television that is in that child's environment, the more symptoms of attention deficit disorder that child is going to show about age 7 or 8.
Dr. Healy, I can remember when, and I distinctly remember this, I was in second grade. No, it was first grade, I'm sorry. When the public broadcasting station in our town in Dallas, Texas, premiered for the first time Sesame Street.
How did I know you were going to say that?
Yeah, it was, and it was hailed at the time. I even remember as a first grader looking at the press material that was put in the classroom for us.
Oh, really?
And it was hailed as a real boon to educators. In a real way that kids, even before they got to school, could get a jump on what they were going to be learning in school. Were we sold a bill of goods, not only with that, but with other educational television?
Yes, you were sold a bill of goods, and parents bought it, and everybody bought it. It seemed like such a good idea. And, you know, to Sesame Street producers' credit, they really did want to help kids get ready to learn. The problem was, and I might add, Todd, I have a chapter in my book, Endangered Minds, which is about the influences of television, the media culture, lack of parental involvement and language, what have you, in children's changes that are making them more likely to have learning problems. Anyway, in Endangered Minds, there's a chapter called Sesame Street and the Death of Reading, if that lets you know where I'm coming down on this. But let me give you a couple of reasons. Number one, the format, particularly the one they started with, and they have backed off on this somewhat, but it's still present, was too fast-paced, too flashy, and too interested in capturing the kids' attention. And this is an important thing to think about, because the producers actually use the term capture kids' attention. And as you know, this is typical of many of the children's television shows, and certainly of the ads that kids see day in and day out. So, okay, how do they capture this attention? By a lot of loud noises, not language, by the way, because little kids are not really listening to the language. They are watching the silly effects and listening to the funny noises. That's what the brain is programmed to alert to, and it will alert to fast-moving visuals and flashes of color and zooms and pans, that really lively format. It does keep them attending to the TV, but let's think for a minute about what might be happening. This is a critical period in their lives when they're actually supposed to be learning to manage their own attention. And here they're having it commanded from outside. Well, is it any surprise that they don't learn how to manage their own attention? And so many parents tell me, gee, my kid is ADD, he's taking medication, and he's, you know, it's a mess, he's not doing well in school, but in front of the television or the computer, he pays perfect attention? Well, the reason is that they're doing it for him. The electronic media are doing it for him, and he's never learned to do it for himself.
That explains a lot, because my wife and I, as so many parents have observed, especially with the younger child when he's watching television, this state of catatosis that is unlike any other waking state I have ever observed. I'd love to be able to put electrodes on his head and see whether or not there's actually any brain activity taking place.
Yeah, well, we need to do that, actually. And I'm so pleased with this study that was published yesterday, which is the one you're alluding to here, in the journal Pediatrics. This is a very good study. It's a medical study, and they have a large group of kids, and they factored out really just about all of the potentially relevant variables, and they really did find a very robust correlation between the hours of television exposure early on and the symptoms of later attention deficit disorder. My hope is, and I've been yelling about this for a long time, because I'm really pretty exercised about what's happening to our kids these days. I've been saying, why doesn't someone do the research? Well, who wants to fund this? You know, these are answers, to be very honest with you, and I don't want to hurt anyone's feelings, that the American public really doesn't want. Parents don't want to hear that plunking their kids down with the TV as a babysitter is not only not a good idea because of the content, but it's really not a good idea because you're changing their brains in ways that are going to make it harder for them to learn in school later on.
What's going on in the toddler's brain, ages 1 through 4, and what effect, what is it about television? It's obviously not just the ambient radiation or the fact that the things in the room. What is it about what's on television being broadcast that affects what's going on in their brain at these early ages?
Well, because we don't have the research, I can't give you chapter and verse on that, but I can tell you from very, very good research, and we know this for sure, what is supposed to be going on, and that is that this child is learning so much. This is a very plastic organism, the brain. In other words, it is being changed all the time by the experiences that this child engages in. And if something's left out, let's say interactive language with other human beings, there's a chance that it's going to be harder to get back later, because these are sensitive periods for many kinds of development: language, self-management skills, sensory skills, coordination. And how do little kids get all this stuff? Well, they get it through human interaction. They also get it through playing with the real-world three-dimensional objects. And you notice that children are just drawn to, they'll do something over and over and over again. I was playing peekaboo with my granddaughter last week. She's 16 months old. And I thought I would die of boredom, but it was so cute and so funny that I kept doing it. All I was doing was pulling a little blanket up over my face and then dropping it and saying peekaboo. We must have done that 100 times. Well, this 16-month-old thought that was the funniest thing. Of course, Grandma's face was pretty funny at this point, but she thought that was the funniest thing she'd ever seen, and over and over and over again, and it was so accessible to her. and it was so real. And there was facial contact, there was eye contact, there was gesture, there was language going on, and it, I could just see those little dendrites sprouting in her brain. And, you know, Grandma may think this is very repetitive, but this is what that little child needs, not a bunch of artificially contrived junk that's going to try to make her pay attention whether she wants to or not. And frankly, the bottom line on all of that is selling products. And I'm sorry, that is not appropriate for kids that age.
Dr. Jane Healy is our guest. We're talking about a new study published in the latest issue of Pediatrics on the relationship between TV viewing and attention deficit disorder, especially among the very young. She's an educational psychologist and professional educator for the last 40 years, author of several books, including Endangered Minds, and her latest book is called Failure to Connect, and she joins us from Vail, Colorado. You join us as well, 505-7850, 1-800-730-2727. First up here, Kathy is calling from St. Louis. Hi, Kathy.
Hi, thank you for taking my call. I have a question for your guest. My son has special needs. He has Down syndrome and autism, and so he's already got a built-in attention problem with those disorders.
Yes.
We do put, we do let him choose videos because for children with autism in particular, it can be very calming to them when they have their behavior problems and their temper tantrums. And we don't give, reward is the temper tantrums, but we give him a liked a disliked activity, and then we give him a liked activity. So we'll say first and then. Like first you have to go potty, and then you can have something that you want to do. You can either do your listening therapy or you can watch a video. And he will a lot of times pick the videos, but we have selected videos, Peter Rabbit and the whole Beatrix Potter series or Corduroy stories put to video. They're different than a lot of the videos that are picked, and we did that intentionally, hoping it would be helpful. And are there better videos than others? Are there some exceptions? I mean,
well, Kathy, first let me congratulate you on obvious good parenting for a kid who's presented you with some very particular problems. How old is your son?
I think, if I'm not mistaken, he's probably right around 4 to 6, somewhere in that
area. Yeah. Well, you know, this child obviously has special needs. Now, what the American Academy of Pediatrics has said is that for children under age 2, now they're referring to normally developing children, but I think this would go for kids like Kathy's son as well. Under age 2, no screen time. But after age 2, it's a little bit more of a value judgment, maybe an hour a day. And I think the sort of thing that Kathy is picking, and my guess is that her son wants to see these same ones over and over again, it's a little bit of the same thing. It's a little bit like having a story read over and over. You know, Good Night Moon gets boring, but the kids still want it. And, you know, frankly, given her circumstance, that sounds like a good solution for her. You know, each family is different, and each family is going to draw their own lines. But what's important is that they understand that lines need to be drawn and that this is not just a benign technology. And then, frankly, neither are computers. Computers for young children, and that's what my book Failure to Connect is about. Computers for young children have been way oversold in terms of the fact they can make your kids smarter, et cetera, et cetera. And really, they have the potential, frankly, to be much worse even than the television in taking kids' attention away from them and substituting a very, very seductive kind of activity that's going to bring them away from the things that their brain really needs to be doing at those early years.
Tim is on the line. Tim, welcome to Issues, Etc.
Yes, I've got a question for your guest also. I have a 3.5-year-old and a 1-year-old. Our pediatrician recommended an hour of TV a day, and we usually keep it right around that. And we do like VeggieTales videos. And
An hour of screen time, that would include computer, video, and television after age 2.
Nothing at all before age 2?
Nothing. No screen time before age 2. That's what the pediatricians have been recommending.
So the study, there's a correlation. If I let my 1-year-old watch along with the 3.5-year-old, that's going to cause problems?
Well, it might. Now, he's got a problem, and Tim, this is a good thing to bring up because you know, it's on in the house. How are you going to monitor the 3-year-old and the 1-year-old at the same time? It, number one, it won't hurt your 3-year-old if he or she doesn't see any screen time.
Yeah.
In fact, especially if the child is playing or if you're interacting with her or there's some language going on or some story reading, you know, or maybe you can manage your 1-year-old's bedtime so that the 3-year-old gets to stay up a little extra special, and that makes being an older child really wonderful, and maybe that would be the time to sit down with the child and watch a familiar video and then talk about it, because the thing we want to avoid is that all this visual eye candy actually starts to substitute for a language development.
Well, we read to our kids books 3 times a day.
Oh, that's wonderful.
But I'm just, you know, did the study that you're talking about, did it measure that in 1-year-olds? Is that going to, you know?
Yes, it was 1-year-olds.
7 or 8?
Now, you know, bear in mind a couple things. Number one, it wasn't a categorical thing. You know, if you turn on the tube once, your kid is suddenly going to have an attention problem. The study looked at the amount of exposure, and you would not believe how much some of the exposure is. It can be up to 7 hours a day in some households. Anything over about 2 hours a day, there was a clear increase in the attention problems. But we do know, again, that for kids under age 2, none is best. But, you know, we have to be realistic, too. And, you know, what would your 3-year-old suffer if her or his TV was severely cut back? Probably not. Probably you're going to end up with a smarter kid.
Dr. Healy, you mentioned something that has my wife and I have observed casually, and that is while the regular programming has a certain hypnotic effect upon the child, the commercials seem to be the heroine of this particular kind of drug. In fact, very early on, our son got the message of the commercials dead clear. As soon as he could speak, he started asking for the things that were being advertised. And I almost wondered whether or not he was watching more for the commercials than for the actual programming as well. What's going on there, not only in the general damage done to the attention, the attention of the child in these early years, but also the pitch that's made in commercial advertising?
Well, it's pretty serious, actually, because the message is really, let's talk first about the message and then the way it's presented. The message itself is saying to these children over and over and over again, if you are to be a good person, if you're to feel good about yourself, if you're to be popular, if you're to be good looking, if you're to be smart, you need to have this product. And over and over and over again, and the products, as you know, are often not something we want them to have, heavily sugared products and what have you. And so the message is a very, very deleterious one if you care about, you know, your child's personal growth and functioning. But the second thing is the way it's presented, and as far as those attention-getting features that grab the child's attention and jazz them up, they are far more prevalent even in the commercials than they are on regular children's television. So, I mean, they have, trust me, the advertisers, and you can't blame them, this is their job, but they have every trick in the book ready to lure your kid into being glued to that commercial. And, you know, it's up to you whether you want to allow your child to be involved in that.
Let's take one last quick phone call from Marie calling in St. Louis. Marie, welcome to Issues Etc. Our time grows very short.
Hi, I'll be very quick, too. What are your feelings about Baby Einstein videos that are supposedly to be shown to even newborn children?
Yes. Well, they're reductive. I think that the real world offers a great deal more. Einstein, trust me, did not have videos. And if he had, who knows, we might still be struggling toward the theory of relativity. That's my opinion.
Your best recommendation, with only a minute here, Dr. Healy, your best recommendation to a couple, they've got children, they've got maybe a typical situation with two children in the house under 4 and the television and the computer, in a nutshell.
First first of all, after they buy and read Endangered Minds and Failure to Connect, then they can, they need to be wise consumers, and they really need to consider that this is something that can and will change their children's brains, and they need to look at the kid and look at the screen and decide for themselves what kind of power they want to have over this.
And to the parent with only 30 seconds here who's raised the kid, they realize they let them sit in front of the television way too much in those early years, and they say, I don't know, my kid does have an attention problem. Your best advice there?
Start, get a good professional evaluation, but start talking. Start showing your child how you solve problems systematically. Sit down at the dinner table and have a family conversation together, and no excuses. That they need to be there with you, and this is an important time for everybody.
Dr. Jane Healy, thank you for being our guest again on Issues Etc.
You're very welcome.
Dr. Jane Healy has been an educational psychologist and professional educator for almost 40 years. She's author of several books. She mentioned them there just a moment ago, Endangered Minds, and her latest book is called Failure to Connect, talking about your children and the computer. She joined us from Vail, Colorado. Oh, the temptation is so great, isn't it? I mean, you've got the thing in the house already, and it's turned on. Turning it off. Have you ever done this with your kids? You walk into the room, and it's time to go someplace, or it's time to do something else. You turn the TV off. You would think you sprayed them with a fire hose. The reactions are often, less than positive. That alone should tell us something. Something that captures our attention and appears, at least to the layman's, my observation, to turn off our brains, even adult brains, too. Maybe the first thing we can do as parents in curbing our children's addiction to television, even in those early years, is to maybe curb our own. I'll tell you this much. If the kids see you doing it, they're going to consider it something that they ought to do, too. Yeah, I know you don't have attention deficit disorder, and I know that you can think perfectly straight. Well, I don't know. Maybe 10 years from now, they're going to come out with studies on old fogies like you and me that our TV time is robbing us of the ability to think as well. You know, we spent some time yesterday talking about the waning attention span of the American churchgoer. You have a better chance of having your kid understand and listen and carefully take in what it is that's being preached on a Sunday morning. If you pay attention to what's going on Monday morning and Tuesday morning when they're sitting in front of the television as well. And I like her advice there at the end. It's never too late to sit down and just sit and have a conversation with your child instead of letting the television carry on the conversation for the both of you. When we come back from this break, we've got Gretchen Passantino. She was by her television last night for 3 hours. I think after reading her review, she found it somewhat troublesome to sit for those 3.5 hours. She was watching Jesus and Paul, Peter Jennings' latest special that was on. We'll get her thoughts on that when we come back.
Defending the faith, teaching the truth. You're listening to Issues Etc.
Many today equate the worship of God with feeling good about God or about themselves. What is the genuine worship of God through which God heals our anxiety, our depression, and our guilt? Where can we find worship that's focused on God's forgiveness rather than our feelings? Our Issues Etc. book of the month for April is called They Will See His Face, Worship and Healing. It's by Issues Etc. regular guest Dr. Richard Iyer. You can order They Will See His Face by going to our website, issuesetc.org. Click on the What's New section. Or you can call Concordia Publishing House, 1-800-325-3040. 1-800-325-3040. The book is called They Will See His Face. When you call or write, mention Issues Etc. 1-800-325-3040.
Evolution. Consider, is it practical?
Answers with Ken Ham, president of the Answers in Genesis Ministry. Well, Ken, evolutionists insist that evolution is such an important part of science today But shouldn't it somehow help these scientists develop current technologies?
You know, you're right. If evolution really was science, which it isn't, of course, then it should be vital in all areas of scientific research, medicine, technology, for instance. I once got a phone call from a man who said he was a Christian. He was very upset with me because he'd heard me lecture against evolution. He said that evolution binds all of science together, and if scientists don't believe it, they won't be able to develop any new technology. I asked him to give me just one example where evolution had helped advance science. He answered by saying, medicine. So then I asked him for one instance. Well, he was stumped. I told him I could give him examples where evolution had caused medical research to go backwards. Doctors, for instance, once believed that our appendix was left over from our evolutionary ancestors, so they'd remove it for no reason. I then asked him for just one example where evolution had helped build any part of the space shuttle. Of course he couldn't. Scientists have been able to develop technology because God created a real world with laws of physics.
Ken Ham and our staff scientists have written some easy-to-understand booklets that will answer your questions about the Bible's first book. Go to AnswersRadio.com to read these free materials. That's at AnswersRadio.com.
This is Dr. John Tape with the Media Minute. Have you ever watched a movie and noticed how brand names are clearly seen? You may hear characters request a certain soft drink or mention the specific name of their shampoo. That is called product placement, and companies pay thousands of dollars to have their product seen on the screen. Don't let your children be fooled by that. Help them to recognize that an ad is an ad, even if it takes place in the middle of a show. And just because the hero brushes with a certain kind of toothpaste, that is no guarantee it will make anyone's smile brighter. Jesus loves your children very much, enough to die on the cross for them. He does not want them to be misled or tricked by deceptive ads. Help your children to recognize product placement ads when they see them. This Media Minute is brought to you by the Christian Media Literacy Institute at www.cmli.org.
It's a story that's found in Matthew 14, Luke chapter 9, and John chapter 6, also in Mark chapter 6. It's the feeding of the 5,000. It has enormous significance for the Gospel of Mark, and we'll talk about it next time with Pastor Ken Wagoner of Peace Lutheran Church in South St. Louis County. The Bible Study, weekday mornings at 10:05.
The Bible Study on AM 850 KFUO is underwritten by Concordia Christian Books and Gifts, serving God's people.
Welcome back. Gretchen Passantino has been kind enough to join us. Actually, her kindness began before she agreed to join us. Her kindness began when she endured 3 hours last night of television and commercials watching Peter Jennings' latest offering on ABC Television, Jesus and Paul. We talked a little earlier in the program with one of the participants in that, Dr. Paul Meyer, and I understand that Gretchen interviewed him as well earlier today. Gretchen Passantino is a regular guest here on Issues Etc. We're going to be talking about the Jennings special, Jesus and Paul. She's co-founder of Answers in Action, based in Costa Mesa, California. Gretchen, welcome back.
Oh, thank you so much. It's good to talk with you, and I'm so glad that so many Christians are interested in what went on with that program last night, because it was seen by so many people who really don't have enough knowledge of Christianity or the truthfulness of Christianity's claims to be able to evaluate what was there. And I was just happy that we were able to watch it and then write some responses to it, which are now posted on our website. And, of course, we're going to have some upcoming articles posted, too, like my article with Dr. Meyer this morning. And I know you've always done a great job at KFUO, and especially on Issues Etc., in helping to equip Christians to be able to share their faith persuasively and rationally and with documentation and evidence.
I want to get into some of that kind of around the water cooler talk that's probably taking place in the workplace or the neighborhood today, of people saying, you know, evaluating the truthfulness of the Jennings documentary last night. But first of all, you have, in a nutshell, characterized what you watched last night as a documentary about a faith that doesn't exist. What do you mean by that?
Well, you know, that line kind of came to me partway through the night when I was thinking of all the things that it could have done but didn't do. And when I was trying to see if I could distill to a single paragraph, what was this show trying to prove? And after I struggled with it for about an hour, I figured out The reason I couldn't distill it down to a paragraph was that there was no one single point the program was trying to make. It wasn't trying to bring us a certain Christianity. Christianity is this, or Christianity is that. Instead, it seemed to go around taking a consensus of opinions. Yeah, a lot of them had PhDs behind their names or big positions or had been in academia a long time, but still going around getting different people's opinions, picking the ones they liked, sometimes putting two people's opinions together that weren't really compatible with each other, but they just sounded like it. And it was kind of like whatever they threw to the wall that stuck, that was okay. Whatever didn't, oh, well, that was okay too. So there really was no one Christianity that Peter Jennings presented as, this is what we think really happened and this is what we think really it is. Instead, we have a whole bunch of opinions that Christianity is wishful thinking, Christianity is the oppressed desiring from some release, Christianity is a protest against Judaism, Christianity is a cosmopolitan alternative to the provincial backwater polytheism of Romanism. You know, whatever it is, it's anything but what the Bible really tells us it is, which is that God loved us so much that he sent his own son to die for us, that believing in him we would have everlasting life.
Would someone, having watched not only last night's documentary, but perhaps even having seen Peter Jennings' previous offering, The Search for Jesus, would they have walked away in any way having learned who Jesus is, or at least from a historical perspective, who Jesus was?
Well, you know, if I had a disease that was treatable by only one certain drug, and if the doctors gave me a broad panel of different kinds of antibiotics and viral fighters and whatever else they had in their chemical cornucopia, I might end up getting healed if the one drug that could actually cure the disease was there in the midst of all those medications. But it might be the case that all the medications that weren't appropriate for my treatment, one of them might actually kill me or might interfere with the operation of the antibiotic that can really cure the infection that I have. In the same way, there were conservative people who know the truth about Christianity who were interviewed in that program last night, but their statements of the truthfulness of Christianity were so obscured by the plethora of other unsubstantiated opinions and presuppositions that for you to find the truth in the midst of all of that would have been close to a miracle, and I don't think Jennings believes in those.
What do you think is the greatest flaw that was represented in the documentary last night, Jesus and Paul?
Boy, that's the same question I asked Dr. Meyer this morning, and after he had told me the sixth one, I said, I'm glad I only asked for one. And I kind of feel like Dr. Meyer right now. I'm not sure that I could boil it down to one. Certainly one of the most obvious ones is that over and over and over again, Jennings brought out his opinion that Paul was the true founder of Christianity and that what Paul founded was qualitatively different and incompatible with what Jesus may or may not have originally stood for. I think another big flaw in the program was assuming that simply because someone with a standing or a degree has an opinion, that opinion deserves equal time with every other opinion. That's an overriding flaw that I see in a lot of contemporary journalism in an effort to be, I'll borrow the phrase from Fox, fair and balanced. We think that no position can be presented unopposed. But if a position is true, and if there is no good evidence or argumentation against it, it's not more fair to present poor arguments and bad evidence in an effort to be fair. That's not really being fair. It has nothing to do with being fair. It's being silly. It's giving equal weight to what is ridiculous with what is actually serious and what is actually true.
All right. Let's see if we can walk through some of the things that people might be talking about as they discuss the ABC special that aired last night, Jesus and Paul. First of all, someone's going to say, you know, I knew it all along. And Jennings brought in the scholars to prove it to me and to reinforce what I always suspected about Christianity, and that is that Christianity is basically a hodgepodge that has been an ever-evolving thing from the very beginning. It bears no real resemblance to Jesus or anything he said or did. Paul got a hold of it, then the church later got a hold of it, and what we have today is just the product of a long series of people's speculations, imaginations, you name it. It's basically bogus.
That is a very strong message that came through the whole documentary. Maybe I could illustrate this best with toward the very end of the program, Jennings was interviewing an archaeologist, his last name is Ponti, in Rome, about first century Rome. And twice Jennings said that it was unbelievable to him that the small little backwater itinerant Jewish preacher from way out in the sticks of the Roman Empire could devise something that ended up being the state religion of the whole Roman Empire barely 300 years later. And he was saying this in the midst of the very archaeological ruins that give us some of the best corroborative evidence to the history that we find in the New Testament that, in fact, that little backwater rabbi did change the world, because he was more than a mere backwater country rabbi. He was the Son of God. And he demonstrated through his life, through his teachings, through his miracles, through his death, burial, and resurrection, that he was God manifest in the flesh. You couldn't take a simple little country rabbi who was nothing more than a self-deluded do-gooder and convert the whole empire, much less the whole world over 2,000 years. But when you take the Son of God, nothing is impossible. It's only unbelievable if there is no God.
The person who says, look, I understand that the unjust death of this backwater itinerant preacher probably left a lasting impression on everybody, and especially on his disciples. And then they have such a zeal to go out and perpetuate this idea of him being the Son of God. I could understand how after 300 years you might have. I mean, look at Islam. Look at the other world. Look at Mormonism. I could understand how that could happen. How do you respond?
Well, a couple of things wrapped up in that. First of all, it was not Jesus' death that the apostles were commemorating as they went about preaching. They were commemorating his resurrection. Yes, his death was necessary and it was on our behalf, but it was his resurrection that provided the proof, the evidence that he was really who he claimed to be, that he could actually accomplish what he claimed to accomplish. When you look at the different kinds of martyrs that we've seen throughout history, whether religious martyrs or political martyrs or, you know, for some other reason someone will die for something they believe in, people may take their teachings, they may take some of their words, they may take some of the standards that they stood for and use them as a guide for their own life or as inspiration to go out and try to change their little corner of the world in whatever way they can. But we're saying something far different with Christianity. We're saying that not merely was Jesus a good teacher, not merely did he care about people who were hurting, but he was God manifest in the flesh, and there is no way that we can be reconciled with God and have eternal life except by believing in him. And we have good evidence to believe that. Another thing people are forgetting when they try to compare Christianity to other religions is that other religions are primarily a philosophy, a way of life, a subjective personal belief. If Buddha never existed, the principles of Buddhism would still make sense to a lot of people. In Hinduism, there are parts of Hinduism that are monotheistic, believing in one God, parts that are polytheistic, believing in many gods, parts that are henotheistic, believing that there's one God among many gods. And it's okay to have all of those contradictory views in the one religion because it doesn't matter whether they really exist or not. But Christianity is the only religion out of all of the world's religions in all history that has said that it is not merely opinion, not merely subjective experience, but it is absolute truth, and it can be either condemned or affirmed by the evidence of history.
Let's talk a bit about the state of scholarship. Some people might have been shocked upon watching this or the previous documentary on Jesus from Jennings that it's not hard for him to come across, as you say, people with scholarly credentials who will, with a completely straight face, deny what Christians have believed for over 2,000 years. They'll deny it outright, the simple facts of the thing. How do you account for this?
Well, just because someone spends a lot of time studying or gets multiple degrees proving that he knows what other people have said and can repeat it back doesn't mean that that person has a strong commitment to truth. I was sitting talking with a young friend this afternoon who was trying to help a friend of hers who was going through a lot of problems. And my friend said to me, I don't understand. The truth is so clear. I think if I can just explain the facts to her, that will compel her to act the right way. And I said, oh, that's one reason you're one of my young friends. Because after a lot of experience, you figure out that most people are motivated not by what their minds tell them, not by rational argumentation, not by a careful evaluation of the evidence, but by their own internal subjective presuppositions. So you can get somebody like Peter Jennings, who doesn't claim to be a scholar in these areas, but claims to have researched the best, and it's very obvious that he does not believe that God exists or that miracles are possible. Therefore, there has to be some other reason, some other way to explain the existence of Christianity. It's very obvious he has no concept of the theological or spiritual reasons for Jesus' death on the cross. Therefore, he's going to go around and find out all kinds of reasons why Jesus, an innocent man, would have been crucified. Couldn't possibly have been God's eternal plan to reconcile humanity to himself through his Son. It had to have been a plot by the Jews or a plot by the Romans or cooperation between the Jews and the Romans or Jesus' own self-delusion about who he was or whatever it is. It couldn't have been God's plan.
We're talking with Gretchen Pasentino about the ABC television special last night, Jesus and Paul. Feel free to join us with a question or a comment. 505-7850, 1-800-730-2727. On the connection with Jennings, does it concern you, Gretchen, that Peter Jennings has at least popularly, I don't think he would claim to be an expert or a scholar in this right, but he has popularly become viewed as, in the journalistic world, as the expert on Jesus and Christianity?
I have to say this as the daughter of a lifetime newspaper journalist, a very, very good award-winning one, and as someone who has had my hand in journalism for nearly 30 years, that an expert in the world of journalism, unfortunately, is not necessarily a true expert. Often the expert is the one who looks the best on camera or who comes up with the most provocative comment or is simply available at the end of the phone when the reporter's dialing around and has a deadline that's coming up. Sadly, though, many people view the world and experience the world through the eyes of journalists, especially through the eyes of television journalists. And it's sad to me that someone like Peter Jennings, who has been given so much outstanding documentation and evidence and argumentation for the truthfulness of Christianity, seems to be completely unaffected by that wealth of information and blessing that God has given him. When I was talking to Dr. Meyer this morning, he said that one of his biggest frustrations with the program was that it was so light on the archaeology, the evidence, and the history that we really do have for not only Jesus, but also for Paul. Dr. Meyer has, and I know you've had him on your program many times and today also, he's written many books and even a couple of historical novels that bring out the wealth of historical detail that we have that confirms the historical documents of the New Testament. For a journalist, someone who's looking to uncover the truth, Jennings spends very little time with the truth.
How were the opinions, the ideas, and the thoughts of conservative biblical scholarship? You mentioned Dr. Meyer. Several others are mentioned in your review on your website of the Jennings special. How were they presented last night on ABC?
Well, it was interesting, and Dr. Meyer noted this too, that in the previous Jennings special, In Search of Jesus, there was a very wide chasm between the liberals and the conservatives. As in that program, so in this program, there were far more liberals than there were conservatives. But the gap between them seemed to be presented in a much more narrow way. In other words, the radical liberals were not quoted for the most part for their radicalness, their radically contentious statements. And the conservatives were not quoted for their most distinctive statements against the liberal approach to the story of Jesus and Paul. Instead, it seemed as though the more middle-of-the-road statements of both sides or both camps were taken, put next to each other, and presented to us as though they agreed.
So in other words, the difference of scholarly opinion on the historicity of Jesus and Paul and the historicity of the claims of the Christian faith were, through the magic of editing, minimized?
Yes, they were. And in fact, I talked with several of the conservatives who were interviewed for the Jennings special, and several of them told me, Witherington and N.T. Wright, especially, and then, of course, Dr. Meyer, too, that they had made certain statements, such as Dr. Meyer said that in one sense you could almost consider Paul to be the co-founder of Christianity, but that statement was taken out of context. In his broader context, he was saying, but we should never confuse that and think that Paul either invented Christianity or that what he did to Christianity was qualitatively different or contrary to what Jesus had done. In fact, he gave me the example that you could compare Jesus to the composer and Paul to the orchestra leader. From the composer, you get the beauty of the original piece of music, the art, and from the orchestra conductor, you get the performance of that art.
He talked earlier today with me about Paul not adding to or extrapolating upon, but he used the term augment, what Jesus presented in its nascent form and very clearly in his ministry and what is presented of him in Scripture. Paul merely augments that.
Exactly. The same kind of people who would see a discontinuity between Jesus and Paul would see a discontinuity between the Old Testament and the New Testament. In fact, we saw that on the Jennings special last night, too. What we see in incipient form in the Old Testament, we see explicated in the New Testament. What we see as brought forth and presented and enacted in the Gospels, we see explained and applied in the letters of Paul. And yet none of those three portions of Scripture contradict each other. And in fact, each one is not only compatible with the other, but taken all together, the three major sections of the Bible, Old Testament, Gospels, and writings of Paul, give us a full-orbed picture of God, of humankind, of our relationship to God, and of the salvation that we so desperately need.
Who is the Jesus that was presented last night on ABC television?
There were many, many faces of Jesus presented in the special last night. But I would say that overwhelmingly, the face that seemed to be the most liked or the most commonly promoted in the program was the Jesus of a simple Jewish country guy who grew up to think that he could change things for his people by bringing the kingdom of God, his own self-appointed messiahship. But the Jesus who is the Son of God, the one who willingly laid down his eternal glory in order to sacrifice himself for us, and who then rose again from the dead by his own power in order to ensure that we will have eternal life, was sadly obscured by all the other different faces of Jesus that were presented.
How would you respond to someone who says, look, yeah, I understand the Jennings had an agenda, that the television network has an agenda, that the liberal scholars have an agenda here to push that would undermine Christianity. But at least people are talking about Jesus, and maybe someone saw something there in those 3 hours of television that might have helped them, even if they didn't clearly see the Jesus of history, the Jesus of Scripture.
What if I were to tell you that I had a young grandchild here in my home and that I enjoyed hitting my grandchild, I enjoyed making fun of my grandchild, I enjoyed frightening my grandchild, but sometimes I gave him a kiss and a cookie. Would you think, oh, well, at least he's getting something good out of it? I don't think so. I think you'd snatch him out of my arms, never let me near him again, and throw the full force of the law at me. Abuse of truth is never excused or condoned by an accidental use of the truth.
In the end, how would you advise someone who's watched this? And certainly with the popularity, the kind of the popularity of Jesus nowadays, given Gibson's film and other things, are going to see other like-minded treatments of Jesus, Paul, the apostles, and the Christian faith in the popular media. How would you advise them to react to this?
Well, first, I would say that if you were confused by it, if you were worried or afraid that some of what Jennings said that denies the truth of the Christian faith, if you were worried that that might be true, there are abundant resources available that can give you good, sound scholarship and argumentation, contrary evidence that that is not the case, that the Christianity that has endured for 2,000 years is the truth. KFUO has a number of resources. Your website at Issues, Etc. has a number of resources. You can access our website through your website, and we have four articles at this moment, particularly on this issue, as well as many other articles, and we'll have other articles coming up during the week that will help to reinforce that. Second, I would say that we have an opportunity as Christians to make ourselves heard. I've talked with people close to the production of this documentary, and they said that the program was strongly influenced by the severe negative publicity and criticism that Jennings received for his first program, In Search of Jesus. That last night's program was more lukewarm. The liberals were kept more in check, and the conservatives were given more opportunity to speak almost completely because of the bad reactions Jennings had before. So this is our opportunity to communicate with ABC, to communicate with Jennings, to communicate to our community around us, letters to the editor or any other forum that you have, what the truth really is and what we would like to see in the media. And third, I would say that it is possible to make a difference. There was a difference in last night's program that we didn't see in the first program a few years ago. You have someone like Mel Gibson who goes out and makes The Passion of the Christ and does nothing politically correct, does not compromise one iota with the view of the world, and comes out with one of the most successful movies of all time. We can make a difference, and we should make a difference, and we shouldn't give up until the society reflects what the truth is instead of what's merely comfortable or appealing. And finally, this is an opportunity to take people who are maybe now open to the message of Jesus who weren't before, to take them to something that's better. Invite a friend who doesn't know Jesus to come to church with you this Easter. Do what I'm doing tonight. I'm taking a whole bunch of people, a bunch of non-Christians, to see The Passion of the Christ, and then we're going to sit around afterwards over coffee and dessert.
We've got 30 seconds here, Gretchen.
All right. So there are things that we can do proactively to bring out the truth of the gospel to others.
Gretchen Pasentino, thank you so much. And I got to thank you for probably staying up late last night.
Late? I went to bed this morning and looked up and the sun was up.
Well, but putting together your initial reactions to the Jennings special last night, thank you very much for being our guest.
Thank you.
Gretchen Pasentino is co-founder of Answers in Action. Based in Costa Mesa, California, you can find several excellent resources. She mentioned them, responding to some of the allegations made last night on Jesus and Paul on the Answers in Action website. Just go to our website first, issuesetc.org, issuesetc.org. Under the links with regular guests, you're going to find a direct link to Gretchen Pasentino and Answers in Action. Tomorrow on the program, a review of Mel Gibson's The Passion of the Christ. Pastor Richard Stuckwish of Emmaus Lutheran Church will be our guest. He's in South Bend, Indiana. And don't miss this, a conversation with Pastor Paul McCain of Concordia Publishing House on how to meditate on The Passion of Christ. I'm Todd Wilkin. Thanks for listening to Issues Etc.
Listen weekday afternoons to Issues Etc. Issues Etc. is a listener-supported program. Your financial support is critical for Issues Etc. to continue. Our address is Post Office Box 9360, St. Louis, Missouri 63117. Or you can contact us via our website at www.issuesetc.org. That's www.issuesetc.org. For a cassette copy of the program, call 1-800-737-0172. That's 1-800-737-0172. Opinions expressed are not necessarily those of this station or the Jubilee Network. Issues Etc. is a broadcast service of the Lutheran Church, Missouri Synod.